Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today it's the mother of all potpourri episodes, including costume design, poetry at the zoo, the art of gardening, world-famous animation, and Beethoven. We kick things off with art historian and Wake Forest University professor David Lubin's take on 19th century book illustrator Howard Pyle. Never heard of Pyle? Well, how about Robin Hood, Pirates of the Caribbean, or Norman Rockwell? Yes, the Pyle footprint is that long and that wide. Then The Simpsons writer, producer, and four-time Emmy Award winner Mike Reiss provides us with a fly-on-the-wall view of the writing room. Next, how do you deepen your understanding of nature by drawing attention to its beauty, diversity, and fragility? The poetry of conservation. North Carolina Zoo poet in residence Bill Griffin's here to share. Then author Diane Ott Wheely has a new book out, Gathering, Memoir of a Seed Saver. She's on a mission to save North America's garden heritage for future generations. Next, after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. A beautiful star-filled night, a warm blanket, and a fantastic outdoor movie. Ah, those were the good old days, right? Well, no, actually. Thanks to Rinalda House in Winston-Salem, outdoor cinema is alive and well, right here in the Triad. Friday night, August 15th, the 9th annual Cinema Under the Stars presents the classic 1977 film Close Encounters of the Third Kind on Rinalda's beautiful front lawn. Showtime's 9 o'clock, tickets are $5, and the feel-good feeling you'll get is on the house. Back in 2012, the Rinalda House Museum of American Art kicked off Cinema Under the Stars with the 1938 Errol Flynn film, The Adventures of Robin Hood. The Oscar-winning classic, along with countless other adventure films that came after it, was greatly influenced by 19th-century book illustrator Howard Pyle. Hollywood directors, costume designers, screenwriters, and more have continually drawn on Pyle's colorful recreations of the past, and movie pirates from the golden era of cinema to Johnny Depp have all worn costumes inspired by Pyle's illustrations. The great Vincent van Gogh himself once wrote that Pyle's work struck him dumb with admiration. Art historian and Wake Forest University professor David Lubin has long been dumbstruck by Pyle's work, too. And his talk, Buried Treasure, Howard Pyle and the Silver Screen, preceded the film at Rinalda. On the 100th anniversary of Pyle's death, David was invited to speak at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington, Pyle's hometown, where the largest collection of Pyle's work resides. Prior to our conversation, David had just returned from another talk on Pyle's work and influence at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Massachusetts. Turns out old Norman Rockwell himself was a Pyle devotee as well.
So I had always heard about Pyle since I was a child. I had loved movies that were inspired by Howard Pyle, comic books, books. I was very aware of his name. And the Delaware Art Museum asked me if I would write an essay for the catalog on Pyle's influence on pirate movies. I was busy. I had other things I needed to do, but that was just too great a topic. I couldn't let it go since I remembered all those nights I used to stay up as a kid watching these Errol Flynn pirate movies. So I took the assignment and I started doing an investigation of Pyle's, specifically his art about piracy. Now, I should say that Howard Pyle was the most influential book illustrator of late 19th, early 20th century America. In fact, he's considered the father of American book illustration.
What telltale aspects jump out at you?
Well, I'd say there are four aspects that jump out of Howard Pyle. First, his line drawings of Robin Hood. He was the one who basically created our image of Robin Hood through these beautiful line drawings he did for an 1883 edition of Robin Hood. Secondly, he did pictures of King Arthur and his knights. And the more you look, the more you see the sort of depths within depths of these fabulous drawings. Then he also did great black and white and color illustrations of pirates. He was fascinated by piracy. This is in the 1890s, early 1900s. He was a Quaker. He said, "Isn't it odd that a Quaker gentleman from Pennsylvania would be so taken with acts of violence and brigandry?" And the final thing that Pyle is remembered for is his children's books illustrations, the fairy tale illustrations he did. And many of his students went on to become famous illustrators of fairy tales.
Okay. So you were enthralled with the prospect of getting to research this further and really talk about Pyle at these in two venues, as it turns out, one beginning in Delaware, then later in Massachusetts. As you're researching this, what were some of the things that kind of set you going? And when did you start making these connections with the past and present?
Well, at first, the essay I was writing for the catalog was very limited on the subjects of Pyle and pirate imagery. And so I was doing a lot of research into how Hollywood in the 1920s, during the silent period, how they were looking back to Pyle. And in fact, the first really famous pirate movie is called The Black Pirate, made by Douglas Fairbanks. And I found out that Douglas Fairbanks, somebody had given him a copy of Pyle's pirate stories. And he was so enthralled by that. Here he's an adult, but he just said, I've got to make a movie of that. And it's so clear that Douglas Fairbanks, who directed the film under a pseudonym, he was directly looking at Pyle. So I wrote the article on Pyle and piracy, and then when the 100th anniversary of his death was coming up and the Delaware Art Museum was putting together this major retrospective of his art, they contacted me. They said, well, we liked your article for the catalog. Would you consider coming to Wilmington and giving a public lecture on Pyle and piracy? And I said, well, sure, I'll do that, but I want to expand it beyond piracy to also talk about Robin Hood and King Arthur, because I realized the more research I did, the more aware I was of how so many facets of Hollywood had been influenced by Pyle. In fact, it's kind of comic that Hollywood has been pirating Pyle's pirate images back from the 1920s. His estate never got anything for all the images that were ripped off and used by Hollywood filmmakers.
How accurate were Pyle's perceptions of pirate garb and even King Arthur's garb and appearances of the day?
Well, Pyle, he became an art teacher. He wanted to give back to his profession. And so he started an art school in Wilmington, Delaware. And some of the most famous illustrators of the early 20th century passed through the doors of that school and trained with Pyle. And he was insistent that when you do an illustration from the past, you have to do all kinds of historical research. You have to go to the library, go to old magazines, read descriptions. He would have his art students sew together costumes based on descriptions in books. And not only that, he would say to illustrators, to his students, if you are depicting some emotion in one of your illustrations, you have to feel that emotion. You have to get into the minds and the hearts and the sort of passions of the character that you're depicting. It's never any good just to imagine, oh, this is what this character would have looked like. You have to really feel the feelings that animate that character. The show left Delaware. It then went to and is still at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. They have an artist-in-residence program, and so I went to the class of an illustrator who's very successful, does a lot of like record covers and magazine work. And it was just really great to hear him say what an incredible influence Howard Pyle has been on him here in the 21st century. So the man's sort of legend lives on, certainly in the world of illustration.
And we've mentioned Rockwell three times. Should point out that he fell under the spell of Pyle.
He very much, as a young man, you know, was so inspired by Pyle. Now, the one difference maybe is that Norman Rockwell had much more of a sense of humor than Howard Pyle. Rockwell was much more about doing illustrations of the present day, wanted to find a narrative angle of human interest in any everyday scene, where Pyle was often, because he was an illustrator, was often taking more dramatic moments from a story. But they still had that desire to find the human life, the sort of the raw inner life of a scene. The curators of the Delaware Art Museum said, well, you're completely right about Pirates of the Caribbean. The filmmakers actually spent a lot of time going through our archives looking at Pyle's images and illustrations. The way Johnny Depp is made up to look is straight out of Pyle.
How about that? How many parallels are there within the industry, the film industry only, of someone who was that influential 150 years ago today? Are there any?
Well, not that many that I can think of, but I mean, Pyle just gave way so easily to Hollywood because he was looking at the past in a sort of dramatic, romantic, but authentic. I wouldn't say authentic in quotes. Again, he's imagining what the past looked like, but in a way that felt very realistic. And so he was a natural for Hollywood. But as I've talked to filmmakers, when I've had an opportunity to meet camera cinematographers and set designers, it's always interesting to me how often, if they're making a movie, particularly a movie set in the past, how often they're going to the art books and looking at the art that painters and draftsmen were presenting of that period.
Hmm. We talked about Rockwell earlier, and I, looking back, it seems like there was only one what I would call a political-leaning drawing of his. One that stands out was the first African-American student being escorted to school with the National Guard there.
Yeah, I just saw that up in the Norman Rockwell.
Were there any parallels there in terms of Pyle's work? Did he have any political statements through his work?
Well, not as direct as that. But I noticed that at the beginning of his career, when he was a young, starving artist just making his way, he was fascinated by Robin Hood. He said that as a kid, his mother had read Robin Hood legends to him. And Pyle, this is a little sidestep, but Pyle's edition of Robin Hood, which was published in 1883, is the first modern compilation of all the Robin Hood stories. These things had been around since the 1400s in various oral traditions and various poems and legends and ballads. But Pyle gathers them together and makes them into basically a novel. And then he illustrates that novel. And that made him famous. Well, one of the things that I concluded, this isn't in the biographies of Pyle, but it's something that struck me, is around 1900, when he was very rich and successful, he's still a good man, but he sort of lost interest in Robin Hood and he became interested in King Arthur instead. And this is purely speculation, but I think that once Pyle became very famous and started hanging out with presidents and Congress people, then a person who robs from the rich to give to the poor was no longer maybe the ideal model for him. And instead, it seems that what he became interested in is modeling the ideal head of state. And that's why I think King Arthur became such an interest to him. At the same time, I was noticing this was in the late 1890s, and he's doing a lot of paintings. This is really when the pirate stuff begins. He starts doing paintings of pirates on the Spanish Main, people stealing treasure from one another and sort of brutal thuggery. And this is at the time when, in American society, we're having a war with Spain to take Cuba away from Spain and also the Philippines. And I think that notion of American imperialism is just getting started during that period. And I think Pyle's illustrations, either directly or indirectly, are talking about, is it right, is it morally right to steal gold from another land, to colonize another island? He has so many images which talk about or dramatize that kind of taking of treasure from someone else.
Wake Forest University professor David Lubin. He spoke with me just ahead of the 2012 screening of the 1938 Errol Flynn movie, The Adventures of Robin Hood, outdoors at Rinalda House Museum of American Art. Rinalda's ninth annual Cinema Under the Stars series continues Friday night, August 15th, with the classic 1977 film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Showtime's 9 o'clock. Tickets are just $5, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And a little art museum trivia for you now. Back in June 2014, the Delaware Art Museum, home to more than 1,400 Howard Pyle works, was in the news for less than desirable reasons. The museum was formally sanctioned by the Association of Art Museums Directors for having sold a painting from its collection, William Holman Hunt's Isabella and the Pot of Basil. The museum was hoping to get between $8 and $13 million for the work to settle a nearly $20 million expansion debt. But it turns out they only got half of their low Christie's estimate. The painting came in at $4.25 million. Ouch. So, how about a little comic relief? After this short break, it's an insider's look at the hilarious award-winning TV series The Simpsons. Our guide will be none other than 28-year veteran writer, producer, and four-time Emmy Award winner Mike Reese. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Simpsons co-creator and producer Sam Simon was in the news this week. In 2012, Sam was diagnosed with colon cancer, and on Wednesday, he announced that he is allowing the ABC News Univision startup network, Fusion, to document the final months of his life. He's a brave man who spent years protecting abused animals. Sam's TV program, The Simpsons, is now the longest-running scripted show in television history. Last year, Sam's colleague, The Simpsons writer, producer, and four-time Emmy Award winner Mike Reese visited the Triad. He was in Greensboro at the Triad Jewish Film Festival, where he presented Jews in Tunes, an animated evening at Temple Emmanuel. It was a hilarious evening featuring rare clips and inside stories from his decades-long career. Mike Reese has produced The Simpsons for 28 years, and he spoke with me by phone from his home in Manhattan.
My first sitcom job was working on the worst sitcom I had ever seen in my life. It was a show called 9 to 5, and it was based on the movie. I used to watch the show before I worked there because I couldn't believe my eyes how terrible this show was week after week after week. And then they called me up. They said, hey, do you want to work on 9 to 5? And I said, do I?
And we're talking about the Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda classic that goes way back.
Right. And then the TV show starred Rita Moreno and Dolly Parton's niece. And the third woman was played by a hairspray model. So they called me in for a meeting, and they said, our show is about this and this. And I go, yeah. And they work in a spoon factory, and Mr. Hart is the big boss, and blah, blah, blah. And they said to me, we've never interviewed anyone who's actually watched our show before. And I didn't tell them, I only watched it for ironic value. But this is a long way to get to the point that here I am walking onto the show, the worst show I ever saw in my life, and the writers were fantastic. They were so smart. They were so funny. And many of them went on and left that show behind and did a lot of great shows. And so it was a good lesson that the people in TV, even when you see an awful, awful show, the guys who make it, the people who make it in TV writing are generally very smart and very driven, and they work hard. You know, you always hear stories about, like, actors leading these lives of excess, but when you're a TV writer, you have to be sharp every single day. That's your job. So you never drink the night before. You don't stay up late. I mean, we're such homebodies at The Simpsons. And, you know, the idea that we're subverting society would amaze anyone who met us because we're all like a bunch of bankers.
And in the industry, has it gotten faster and funnier? Or was Jack Benny, just as quick in that the times change? How was the industry evolved along those lines?
You know, I think they were always like this. I had the privilege, you know, when I started out, I was the young guy. Now I'm the ancient guy. But I worked with much older guys who would talk about working on The Farmer's Daughter and, you know, My Friend Irene or whatever these shows were called. These were the guys who worked in TV in the days when TVs ran on kerosene. And they were so funny. They were wonderfully funny and sharp and irreverent. It's not like, oh, it was a different kind of comedy. They were outrageous guys. But I will say, I mean, if you don't know, TV and sitcom business is a business of young men. And it's not even ageism exactly. It's a lot of the fact is just the hours are tremendously long, and an old guy like me can't quite put in those hours. And an older person is not plugged into popular culture, which is so important for a lot of shows.
You had asked yourself in one of the Simpsons stories talks I viewed, what would you do if you couldn't write comedy? And answered with, I'd write for King of the Hill.
Now, oh, did I say that?
You did say that. Now, you don't come across as a rivalry-prone guy, but I'm wondering, is there a big rivalry between the leading tune shops or friendly rivalry? How does that dynamic play out?
There really is no rivalry at all. There's shows we like and shows we don't like. I actually, since I did that joke, I've changed it to Jay Leno. And Jay Leno is a guy I feel I can attack with impunity. King of the Hill was just a show I thought was, you know, deliberately much too slow-paced. I mean, that was it. They said, let's do The Simpsons, but we'll make it so slow-moving that even people from Texas will enjoy it. So that was it. That was my go-to joke. But we all, you know, we're sort of friendly with the South Park guys, and we had a little bit of a rivalry. It was sort of asymmetrical warfare where we would attack Family Guy. We would attack that show and call them a ripoff, and they were always so kind to us. They were always so nice, and the bloodshed has stopped.
Well, I'm sure you're going to be warmly received here in Greensboro, North Carolina. But I understand from a recent talk that you gave that The Simpsons have not been, well, let's just say they've been less than warmly received in other parts of the world.
Yes, it's, The Simpsons is sort of loved almost everywhere in the world. It's a hit in 71 countries. But whenever we do an episode where the Simpsons visit another country, that country gets furious and cancels the show. And that happened in Japan. They canceled us. In Brazil, we were sued by the Brazilian Tourist Council after the Simpsons went to Rio. And in Australia, we were condemned in the Australian Parliament, which is a Hooters, by the way. And it made me realize, oh, gee, when other countries love The Simpsons, they love it because they don't think, oh, this is a parody of humanity or how people live or families. They go, they're making fun of America. And so they love the show until we come to their country and do to their country what we do to America on a weekly basis.
So much going on in this country that we'd all like to see improved or nudged in one way or the other. Is it satisfying? Is it fun? What's the feeling like when you're reaching tens or hundreds of millions of viewers with your point of view or your writer's point of view presented in a funny way? Or give me an example of one that was satisfying for you particularly.
Gosh, I remember, I have only the vaguest memories of this, but it was around 2002, 2003, where, right after 9/11, where Springfield became very anti-immigrant, and they started instituting, like, citizenship tests for people like Apu. And I was very glad to do that we were taking a stand against this sort of chauvinism and, you know, international racism and that kind of thing. I was very glad to see that we could at least go on record saying America has sort of lost its moorings and forgotten what it's all about.
That was back in the days of the Freedom Fries.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, of course, one of the worst things was that we had a character refer to the French as cheese-eating surrender monkeys.
I remember that line.
Was it. And then the Republicans in Congress took up this banner. They said, yes, they are cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And it's like, don't you remember we put that line in the mouth of one of our idiot characters?
That's such a great example. I remember that line because I laughed out loud when I heard it.
And there were four of us in the room when the line was written. And when the line became famous, the four of us got together and said, who thought of this? And no one could remember. You know, something that really took the imagination, took the world's imagination by storm. None of us have any recollection of writing the line. Somehow one of us, or probably was a gang effort, you know, I might have thrown in surrender, something like that.
Is that typical, Mike, where I mean, literally within a gag, portions of it are contributed by different individuals, or was that a unique case?
It does happen a lot like that. It does happen. Somebody will have the basic idea, and then someone will have an extra improvement on it. By the way, this is how The Simpsons is written. One of our writers will write an original script, and then the other 22 writers will come in and just go over it and rewrite it from top to bottom 8 full times. And if you wrote the greatest Simpsons script in history, by the time it hits the air, 20% of your original script is left. And very often, none of your original script has survived. And you don't take it personally. That's the only way to get fired at The Simpsons, is if you start fighting and saying, oh, you're wrecking my script, or give this joke another chance. I've worked with the show for 25 years, and I think everybody, after a point, realizes how much energy they can give to the show. So a lot of us old-timers work a day a week, or 2 or 3 days a week. Very few of us put in a 5-day week. But when I walk in there, I'm just this cog in the machine. The Simpsons machine is always running, and we're writing new shows that'll be airing a year from now, and we're tweaking shows that'll air next Sunday. And you walk in on any given day, and you just jump in there, and you work on whatever is going on. And all the work is done communally. It's done by 10 guys sitting around a table. Everyone has a script in front of them, and we'll go through a line at a time going, can this be better? Who's got something better here? Who's got something better here? And my job is just to throw out jokes all day, throw out jokes and maybe story ideas. And if I can make half the people in the room laugh, it goes in the script. So it's a democracy of laughter. It's a laughocracy.
I love that.
The Simpsons, writer, producer Mike Reese. Last year, the 4-time Emmy Award winner spoke at the Triad Jewish Film Festival in Greensboro. The festival builds bridges of understanding by showcasing Jewish identity through dynamic, contrasting films, community outreach, and comedy.
Mike's presentation was titled Jews in Tunes, an Animated Evening at Temple Emmanuel. Mike's also independently produced internet cartoon series, feature films, and he's published 17 children's books, including How Murray Saved Christmas, published by Penguin. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Time to get up, stretch our legs a bit, and what better location for a nice walk than the zoo? The North Carolina Zoo, to be precise. In addition to being a phenomenal zoo with fantastic natural displays and scenic views throughout, it also has a wonderful educational program that harnesses the power of the arts to engage people with nature and conservation. It's called The Poetry of Conservation, and the zoo's poet in residence is family physician and geriatrician Bill Griffin. Bill's given workshops for kids ages 7 to 14 where they learn about animals by putting themselves in their walk and their talk. Bill also talks about the techniques of writing a persona poem. Older teens and adults can enjoy Bill's workshop, Naturalist Poet, Poet Naturalist. You'll enlarge your perspective, inform your writing, and expand your impact as poets. Bill spoke with me by phone from the North Carolina Zoo.
All the times I've visited the zoo, you know, I've been struck by how it not only gives you a sense of the exotic, but also brings you right here home to the Piedmont, you know, because of the setting and because the displays bring the, you know, wild animals close to you. I had a close encounter of the herpetologic kind. I was coming back from a program, and right outside the Sonora Desert exhibit, they have a wonderful rock garden, and this black and white streaked lizard jumped up on a rock, and I thought, I've never seen one of those before. He looks like he escaped from the Sonora Desert, and we were actually just looking him up online, and he actually is a southeastern fence lizard, so he's native, but he sure looked like he belonged in that rock garden.
I'll bet. Well, your background is in medicine, family physician, and geriatrician in rural North Carolina, talking the Elkin area. Talk about that entree for you into then the world of poetry.
I had some very inspiring teachers in high school and college, and so I kept up with reading over the years, but never really did much writing until about, about 15 years ago, I took a workshop from Joseph Bethanty, who's now at Appalachian State, on reading contemporary poetry, and among the poets we read was A.R. Ammons, and I read the poem Hymn, which he uses a lot of scientific language to bring us not only close into the tiniest aspects of nature and creation, but also into the farthest reaches. And I thought, oh my gosh, science and poetry, they belong together.
You mentioned A.R. Ammons, and I can't think of a better kind of bridge between the world of science and poetry. Could you read a stanza or two from him?
He says, I know if I find you, I must go on out over the sea marshes and the Brant and Bay, over the canyons, crater lakes. And he keeps taking it out in the spiraling circles, you know, out into the atmosphere, out into space. And at the end he says, and I know if I find you, I will have to stay here with the separate leaves. So the sense I get from that is that to really discover the meaning in, within ourselves, as well as the meaning of our place within our neighborhood, our habitat, our environment, it's not as if nature is out there and then where we live is something else. It's all part of one earth. Environmentalist from Africa, Baba Diom, said, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We love only what we understand. We will understand only what we are taught. So the teaching aspect of us learning, you know, about the creatures and about the places they come from might inspire us to care for them to the point where we will conserve them, and by doing that, then we preserve ourselves.
Talk about how your art does bring about some innovative ways to communicate that message.
I think poetry can teach with a metaphor or with some really vivid image and slips right through the bars of your logical thinking and teach directly to your heart.
Well, you're no stranger to this world of bringing nature to the fore through poetry, and I'm referencing here the 2008 collaboration with your wife, Linda French Griffin, to create this book, Snake Den Ridge. That's out on March Street Press. I'm looking at this list of characters that you've sketched out here, squirrels, crayfish, salamanders. Could you pick one of those from the book and maybe treat us to one of those poems?
Okay, sure. I like to read you one of my favorites, Salamander. You know, in the Smokies, each watershed has its own distinct salamander species. So each one of these poems, the creature is actually speaking directly to the reader in first person. So this is Salamander. This is my gift to change. From Inadu Creek, I leave behind my frilly gills and climb the spire of blue-eyed grass. Having become a creature of air, bathing myself in dew, am I not still a creature of water? I invite you to discover in each of my family our variations. Discern that every runnel, every spring, every palm-sized cup of moisture holds its lithe expectation. For this is my gift to you, to notice changes. I will let you lightly touch the welcome of my smoothness while I drink a little warmth from your hand. Now count the dapples down my length. Measure the blush of my cheek. Then find, when you descend the eastern face of Snake Den Ridge, those subtle alterations my cousins are accumulating until finally they acquire a new name. And when you have returned me to my bed of blue bead lily, then touch a smooth place within yourself and carry with you into the world your own changes.
Well, that's really nice, Bill, on so many levels. I love the image there of climbing the spires of the blue-eyed grass and then petting the smoothness of the skin, sharing that with the warmth of the hand, and then it comes back at the end to really forge that collaboration.
Well, I would hope that, you know, each creature in speaking something from within itself kind of touches the reader to find something within themselves that's maybe new or different or something they hadn't been aware of. And all the poems in the book also have a little backstory of an encounter behind them. The salamander we ran across as we were hiking the trail up to Clingman's Dome, and he had climbed up a spire of grass, and there he was with his red cheek. It was Jordan's red-cheeked salamander.
Great.
Which only exists in the Smokies.
Oh, hey, could you leave us with one more of your poems about nature? A short one about any of your favorites. That'd be great.
Sure. This is from a real bear encounter I had up at Cosby Knob Shelter, which is currently closed in the Smokies because there's too many bears up there. But if you hear me, it will be a nut falling from the buckeye. If you hear me, it will be a dry branch seeking earth. It will be slender fingers of mountain ash waving praises to the ridge-lined sky. If you see me, it will be a shadow only one breath deeper than twilight. If you see me, it will be the twist of heart that skips a beat, the stark of pupils gone abruptly wide. I am mist that enfolds the laurel. I am stone that reclines beneath black hemlocks. I am a rumor at Madryn Bald, a tremor at Mount Gaio. Raven is mistaken. This ridge is mine. And if you hear me, it will be the rising chest of the mountain and its timeless, slow exhale. And if you hear me, it will only be because I didn't hear you first.
Oh, the menacing bear. That's great. I love how that pivots in that such a jazzy way with Raven is mistaken.
Yeah, Raven thinks he knows it all, but no, bear is the boss.
North Carolina Zoo poet in residence, family physician, and geriatrician Bill Griffin. The zoo hours are 9 to 5 through October, and they're open every day of the year except Christmas. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now. Attention gardeners, you may want to stay put, because when we return, it's everything, and I mean everything, you ever wanted to know about heirloom seeds but were afraid to ask. Author Diane Ott Wheely has a new book out, Gathering Memoir of a Seed Saver. She's on a mission to save North America's garden heritage for future generations. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Art of Gardening is up next. Diane Ott Wheely is co-founder and vice president of Seed Savers Exchange, the nation's leading nonprofit organization dedicated to saving and sharing heirloom seeds. This extraordinary organization was begun back in 1975 with just a few seeds, and it's grown to include over 600 varieties of vegetables, flowers, herbs, and plants, including 74 types of tomatoes. Today, Seed Savers has more than 13,000 members. There are orchards, ancient White Park cattle, heritage poultry, and even trout. Diane's new book, Gathering Memoir of a Seed Saver, is about the exchange and its mission to save North America's garden heritage for future generations. In 2012, Diane brought her message of hope to Old Salem Museums and Gardens with a lecture in Gray Auditorium, followed by a book signing and local heirlooms tastings. Diane spoke with me by phone from her farm in Iowa.
I'll begin then with my visits to my grandparents' farm, which probably shaped my future more than I ever thought it would at the time. But I grew up in the northeast corner of Iowa and very rural with small farms. My grandparents' farm was about 5 miles from where the dairy farm that I grew up on. So a really strong childhood memory were trips down to visit my grandparents on summer evenings. My dad would come in from milking and he'd say, we should, you know, go down and see how Grandpa and Grandma are doing. And that was just always a real fun evening. We'd take the back roads up and wind back to his farm through cornfields and along the river and up past his sawmill. And the road was called the Bass Creek Hill. I thought that was just so much fun to go to his house and my grandmother's. And we would come into his yard and we'd pile out of the car. The first thing we did was look at his gardens in the summer. And they would have 4 or 5 different gardens scattered throughout their yard. And they were so proud of their gardens. I mean, they grew a family of 9 children during the Depression. And my grandmother's grocery list was vinegar, sugar, flour, coffee, and a few spices. And everything else was raised from their land and what their hands could produce. So looking back at it now, I just think what a ideal life. Most people are trying to get back to that today, and they were doing it out of necessity, but they were also enjoying it. But anyway, we would end our evenings on the porch, and my grandfather would have morning glories that he had trained up alongside of the east side of the porch, but he'd leave an opening, a square or circle or triangle, so we could sit on the porch and we'd watch cars go by, and he'd have stories like, you know, they're late for milking again, or they never stay home, and I wonder where she's going now. You know, so I was just sitting there listening to my grandfather's loud, robust voice. And, you know, it was just my cozy morning glory room. So when I had my first garden with my then husband, Kent Whaley, we decided we needed to have some morning glories growing on our porch. When we went down to visit him, we asked him for some of the seed, and he was very happy. He handed us a little white pillbox full of black morning glory seeds, and he said that his parents had brought the seed over from Bavaria when they immigrated in the late 1800s. So, you know, so I'm holding this box of seeds and thinking, I never even thought about great-grandparents or where they lived and what their life was like. And so here I'm holding a box of seeds that is a living connection to a family that I hadn't ever met. And later that winter, he passed away, and Kent and I realized what a gift he had really given us. And if he hadn't given us that seed, it might have been lost, and the story lost as well. And he also gave us some great tomato, German pink tomato seeds. So at that time, also, you know, there was a lot of fuss about hybrids, and everybody wanted to grow hybrid seeds in their garden because they thought they were new and improved, and they had to be better than the older varieties of open-pollinated seeds. So a lot of seed companies were dropping heirloom open-pollinated seeds from their catalogs, so a lot of those seeds are disappearing. Also, larger seed companies were buying out smaller seed companies, so there was a consolidation in the seed industry at that time. And I think the small farms were being replaced with larger commercial farming projects. So there was I think it was a critical time. That was around 1975 when we started Seed Savers, because we saw all these dangers around us, and we thought if we, you know, it was up to us to save my grandfather's seed, but also start a nonprofit and maybe be available for other folks to send their seed to us to maintain as well.
Well, I'm wondering, Diane, if you could put into perspective just how important this work is in terms of, you know, what we stand to lose without it.
Well, I mean, when we lose a seed, we lose a lot of genetic diversity. And, I mean, if the variety disappears, we're losing something that was part of our culture, part of our diversity. And that was happening at an accelerated speed at that time. So we wanted to save all the pieces because there was this, when immigrants came into this country, they brought with them a wealth of seeds because they did not know what they'd find here to plant in their gardens, and they wanted to have the foods that they were accustomed to from their homeland. So they brought with them a lot of seed into this country. And it was during that time when a lot of these elderly farmers were passing away or moving off the farm, you know, and there was a huge amount of genetic diversity in these family heirlooms that we were losing. So there was a lot of things contributing to it. Plus, it just instinctively was the right thing to do.
Sure. Diane, what kind of reactions have you had from folks attending the book signings? What are readers saying? Because you've got a whole lot of activities planned here in Winston-Salem.
Yeah, it's been so encouraging to meet so many people out there that are really trying to contribute in some way to their food, to their culture, to their environment. And, you know, I tell people so often, we can save the seeds, and we will save all these seeds, but it's you, the gardener, who can grow them. We can't grow gardens all over the country to keep this seed viable and growing again. So I've been enjoying it. I've met some incredible people, and that's the one thing. I know that we'll never probably be short of wonderful seeds and wonderful people. That's the theme that kind of goes through Seed Savers, I think, are seeds and people and stories and the stories that bring them together.
Co-founder and vice president of Seed Savers Exchange, avid gardener and author Diane Ott Wheely. Diane's new book, Gathering, Memoir of a Seed Saver, tells the story of the exchange and its mission to save North America's garden heritage for future generations. 2 years ago, Diane spoke about it at Old Salem Museums and Gardens. Gardens have been an essential part of life in Salem since the town was established back in 1766. In 1845, Salem was described by a Salisbury, North Carolina newspaper, the Carolina Watchman, this way, quote, "Its style and manners are very city-like, and no place of the same size contains as many plants and flowers. In every window, yard, and garden you behold them, and some of very beautiful and rare order. If a great fancy for flowers argues a corresponding taste for all that's beautiful and lovely, then the people of Salem are unsurpassed." Close quote. Old Salem Museums and Gardens continues to celebrate the history of this unique Moravian town through the preservation and restoration of the gorgeous buildings, gardens, and landscape there. The Old Salem Horticulture Program maintains impressive gardens that feature open-pollinated heirlooms, and seed saving is a core mission. From the Mickish family backyard garden to the expansive Single Brothers garden, Old Salem's award-winning restorations might just inspire ideas for your own garden. You can stop by any day of the week, and you'll find links to the complete goings-on at Old Salem and Diane Ott Wheely's latest book, Gathering, Memoir of a Seed Saver, on our website. It's WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. WFDD's local performance broadcasts continue tonight at 8 o'clock with the Eastern Festival Orchestra, led by Eastern Music Festival music director Gerard Schwartz and guest soloist, internationally renowned violinist James Ennis. Beginning in September, the program will feature live performance recordings of the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Maestro Dmitry Sitkovetsky. Earlier this season, we talked about his performance of Beethoven's Violin Concerto Opus 61 with the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra in January.
Such an incredible story. It's such an incredible piece of music. So compelling. The second movement is so divine. The first movement is epic, really. It's just an incredible. It could have been a concerto in itself. But then the second movement just takes you completely to heaven. And then the last moment is so full of vigor and fun and humor and beauty. And it's just a sensational piece. I believe it's the best concerto Beethoven ever wrote for any instrument.
I find that when people say, some critics, they're out there, they say, oh, Beethoven couldn't write a melody. You just say, well, listen to the Larghetto from this concerto. I mean, it's some just beautiful
writing. Are you kidding? Oh, my goodness. I mean, and my favorite cadenza to this concerto is by Fritz Kreisler. I mean, what he does, which is a stroke of genius, he combines two themes of the first movement into a double stop, double melody in the violin solo. It's quite extraordinary, and they fit so perfectly well. Probably one of the most melodic pieces Beethoven ever wrote. And as I said, in the violin part, all the more dramatic or more bigger gestures in the first movement, they all belong to the orchestra. Violin never really has all that Sturm und Drang in its part. It's very, very lyrical. It's very unlike your sort of archetype Beethoven kind of music.
I got a chance to see and hear your performance. This is on YouTube. Thank goodness for YouTube, of the famous third movement, Rondo Allegro with the NHK Orchestra. It was another Dmitri conducting, Dmitri Kitayenko.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
First off, I just love the tempo that you lock in on that. Not too fast, not too slow. How do you get that just right? I mean, how do you make those decisions? Leading up to that performance, in the moment.
Well, it's finding the right tempo, and in general, in music, the question of rhythm and then the pulse and the tempo very often is more important than actually having an absolute pitch or a perfect pitch, whatever they call it. And it is something that you have to have inside of you. And I think also for a conductor, the memory for tempi is one of the most important qualities to have. And being sort of a performer, conductor, for me, finding the right tempo and keeping it. You have to have a tremendous amount of homework done, but then when you come out, you have to feel the hall. You have to feel the audience, and sometimes you speed up certain things, and sometimes you slow down certain things, or you keep exactly the one that you brought out. It also depends on your pulse, how excited, nervous, or whatever your state of mind. That all comes into consideration, and it affects one's performance.
I want to get off the stage for just a moment with you, Dmitri, and get into the recording studio, because 5 years later, you recorded this concerto with Sir Neville Mariner, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. Do you prepare differently for a recording session than for a live situation?
Yes and no. Yes, because, in the recording situation, especially these days, you can't afford not to be perfect. While in a live performance, you can create an illusion of being perfect, but when you listen to the tape, it's actually not perfect. And if you, in a live concert, if you're trying to be perfect, you'll miss other important elements, spontaneity and risk-taking and all of that. But in the recording situation, where you have to have that lively feeling, like it is a live performance, I can't really listen to recordings that are so clearly just a recording.
How has your conception of the piece changed then over the, just the 34, 35-year history with this piece? Could you give us an example or two of how it's, evolved over that time?
Well, I think one gets so much more familiar with the piece. It becomes your friend, your companion, or, you're no longer just looking up so your neck hurts. When you look up at the big mountain, your neck begins to hurt. You're always looking up. So you sort of more on level terms, you feel more familiar. It's not so, it seems like such an impossible task when you're just beginning to play the first, I don't know, probably first 10 times at least. It's always daunting, you know, that concerto. But as you get closer to it and you feel familiar, it's sort of like a role that you've played. You know, if you played Hamlet, I don't know, 100 times, you certainly found things there. And it's all in small. Devil is always in the detail, and genius is also in detail, in small things. It's not that I'm going to turn things upside down and, you know, and do it dramatically different. No, but it's the smaller things. And in my case, I think I'm interacting with every instrument, with every section, so much more now than I used to do it when I first started playing it. That I think that affects and enriches my playing, I think, a great deal, because I could react and respond to all the wonderful players there, and it gives me more impulses and ideas, and my responses are a lot more interesting over the years. So it very much depends on the company I keep.
Violinist and Greensboro Symphony Music Director Dmitry Sitkovetsky will be keeping company with his orchestra during WFDD's local performance broadcast on Friday, September 19th. He'll be joined by renowned pianist Alexander Schimpf, a performance recorded live on May 8th, 2014. You'll find links to the complete GSO performance schedule on our website, wfdd.org. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our interns are Michaela Nance and Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts at WFDD.org. And you can follow Triad Arts Weekend on Facebook. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.